This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by OnX Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. On this episode of the show, we talk with Upland Hunters Tyler Burton and Dan Hornbaker. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 262. All right, welcome to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for joining us this week. A conversation with Tyler and Dan coming at you in just a few minutes. Got a couple things I want to mention before we get to that. A couple of limited time opportunities, so hang with me for just a minute if you're interested. I'll thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making voluntary contributions in support of the show. They get access to some bonus content, Patreon giveaways, and Birdshot Podcast canned coolers and stickers. A little swag pack for y'all. I'm going to give away an OnX Hunt Elite subscription card this month to Patreon patrons. All patrons signed up by the end of the month will be eligible for that. I'll be working on some other giveaways coming up a little bit later this year, so I'll keep you posted on those. You can learn more and sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. All right, I also want to mention a limited time sale from our friends at Final Rise going on right now, depending on when you're listening to this, through March 17th. So less than 10 days left on this sale. It's a once a year sale that the folks at Final Rise do, usually aligned with Pheasant Fest. So we're just coming off that Pheasant Fest weekend, and the sale is available to anyone out there to utilize the promo code FR24. That will save you 10% site-wide at finalrise.com. So that's everything from a new upland bird hunting vest. Perhaps you already have your Final Rise vest, but maybe you need a camel version for turkey season, which is right around the corner. I'll be wearing my Bottomlands Summit vest in the spring woods once again this year. Can't wait. How about a new gun case, the new brush pants? They've got the hoodies, maybe just a hat, t-shirt, their whole lineup of accessories and related gear. Whatever you need, Final Rise has got you covered once again for a limited time through March 17th. You can use the promo code FR24 to save 10% on everything at finalrise.com. And while you're at finalrise.com, you might want to check out another very limited opportunity conservation fundraiser that will not only benefit the mission of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, but there'll be a few nice perks in it for the 100 people that are able to take advantage of this. As you probably heard me mention, Upland Gun Company, Final Rise, and OnX Hunt all had a joint booth together at Pheasant Fest, and during the planning and staging process for that, Matt over at Final Rise wanted to bring everybody together and do something similar to what they did last year when they did the hat sale that ultimately raised like $1 million for the Pheasants Forever conservation mission. It was crazy. This year, it is scaled down a little bit and much more limited, but there's still a lot of value in it for these 100 people that get a chance to purchase one of the Yeti conservation mugs from finalrise.com. So I'll give you a little background, and I will drop a link to this in the show notes. There's only 100 of these available, and I'm not sure of the timing and promotion of everybody's marketing channels. So it's quite possible that by the time you hear this and go check out this link, they could all be gone. I have no idea, but I'm giving you a heads up as early as possible when this episode launches right away on Friday morning. So if you go to the link, you will find Yeti Conservation mugs. There's a custom logo on there displaying Onyx Hunt Final Rise Upland Gun Company logos. There's a really cool Onyx Hunt style map on there with some cool waypoints. And for your $100, you will get one of these Yeti tumblers and a 1-year subscription to Onyx Elite. So there's a Yeti tumbler and a $99 Onyx Elite subscription for your $100 investment. All of the proceeds from the sale of these Yeti tumblers will go to the Pheasants Forever Path Initiative in support of their conservation mission. And in addition to all of that, everybody that buys one of these Yeti conservation mugs will have a shot to win one of 4 prizes that include a new kennel from the folks at Lucky Duck Kennels, a Final Rise Summit XT vest with custom embroidery, an Onyx Elite lifetime membership, or a $1,000 voucher towards a custom gun from UplandGunCompany.com. So once again, you put 100 bucks up for the Pheasants Forever Path Initiative, you immediately get a Yeti tumbler and a 1-year subscription, $99 value, to Onyx Elite, plus a chance to win one of those 4 prizes. The link is in the show notes. Don't sleep on this one. They will go fast. Now's your chance. Pause the episode, go grab one, and then come back in and join us for a conversation with Buffalo Burton and Shotgun Dan. All right, let's get on with our show today. Tyler Burton is someone that I recently connected with, worked with him through Upland Gun Company, and while Tyler and I were putting his gun build together, I was continually having to answer questions and provide input based on the feedback he was getting from an anonymous third party, which turned out to be Shotgun Dan, aka our other guest on today's show. And it was all in good fun, and the premise of this conversation is that Tyler is pretty new to upland bird hunting. He found himself with a hunting breed dog and then became curious about bird hunting, took the initiative on his own, and was out walking in the woods one day and ran into Dan, a lifelong hunter and soon-to-be mentor to Tyler. Those two became fast friends, and I wanted to get him on the show today to dive a little bit deeper into that mentor-mentee relationship and hear from two upland bird hunters that are at very different points in their upland hunting journeys, but as is often the case, have found instant common ground in their shared passion for bird dogs, upland birds, and shotguns, which are 3 things that bring many of us together year after year after year. So with that said, let's welcome into the conversation and onto the Birdshot Podcast, Tyler Burton and Dan Hornbaker.
Well, my question would be gun related, so you could hit record or not, it doesn't matter, but I just want to know how you got involved with UGC.
Well, I actually told that story a couple times over the weekend at Pheasant Fest. It was kind of a right place, right time thing. As I look back, and sometimes I ask myself the same thing, and it really was, I sort of took a fork in the road with my career when I joined the Ruffed Grouse Society. That was back in 2015, and for a while I didn't really have a plan. Well, I had zero plan, but I wondered, could I make a shift towards hunting outdoors, you know, the things I like. And that move basically led to everything else. That's how I met Jerry Havel, one of the original founders of Upland Gun Company, and got to know him over the years and kind of collaborated with him on some things. And then, you know, fast forward, like, I guess it would have been five or 6 years later, Upland Gun Company launched, and I was helping out a little bit behind the scenes, not really officially on the team or anything. And just the initial success, it was like right during the COVID pandemic, and it just was one of those things where kind of stars aligned, and they were busier than they thought they would be right away. And I had additional capacity, what I was doing. I was still doing the podcast at the time, but just kind of was talking to Jerry one day, and he's like, think you might be able to help us with some of this stuff, because he and Dan had a certain skill set and I have a little bit different one. And it'll be 3 years, I think. I got to confirm this, but I was trying to figure that out. 3 years in May, I think. So, yeah, that was the step.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I can say I work with a gun company and an Italian gun manufacturer. And if you would ask me what I'd be doing 4 years from now, 4 years ago, I don't think I would have come up with that. So that's how life works, though, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we are rolling on the Birdshot Podcast, and I'm pumped to have Tyler and Shotgun Dan on the show with us here tonight. we're gonna have some fun, and been looking forward to this one. We rescheduled it once. I think my schedule's been a little bit crazy, but I'm back from Pheasant Fest now and a really busy couple weeks of travel. What have you guys been up to? We're all, like, I talked to so many people over the weekend at Pheasant Fest. We're all in this sort of weird non-winter weather pattern, so like people are out running dogs on wild birds and doing all kinds of stuff. What have you been up to lately, Dan?
I've been other than work, getting ready to work on the boat, and I've been doing some trap shooting Thursday night.
Nice.
A little bit on Sundays, just kind of wetting my feet on it. It's a lot closer than the sporting clay range, and it doesn't take as much time, so it's a new adventure.
Trap shooting is new for you? I was going to ask if that was something you did quite a bit.
Like actual trap shooting with, you know, like real trap? Yeah, I'm kind of new to that, but I've shot sporting clays for years. A lot of vintage clays, side-by-side clays.
Yep.
Did a lot of that.
So I'm gathering trap range is closer, something to do. Basically, is that kind of the reason for it?
Keep the gun in my hand.
Right.
I think any shooting discipline is going to help your wing shooting, whether it's skeet, sporting clays, trap. Any one of them you can get out and do is going to help you in some way.
Yeah, there's ways you can kind of, whether or not you're competing or just out there farting around or whatever, but you can kind of switch things and, you know, start from a low gun mount and all that kind of stuff. You can kind of make them work for you. But to your point, you're still mounting the gun, pulling the trigger, looking at targets, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that hand-eye coordination.
Yep.
Your mount. I mean, you're pre-mounted trap shooting, but still, it's target acquisition is huge grouse hunting. So
yep,
the quicker you get the gun on a bird, the better chance you have. So the more you practice it, the better your chances are of getting a bird.
Yeah, I still don't think I've ever shot an actual round of trap. I'm usually shooting sporting clays. I've done a little bit of skeet. Not as much as I would like to. In fact, it's kind of a goal of mine to get out and shoot a bit more this summer. So, and this early spring might help with that too, because usually in the depths of winter, we're not really shooting much in this part of the world. But I got to check. Again, my schedule's opening up now, so I'd love to get out there and bang a couple targets.
I guarantee your local trap club is shooting. Those guys get the shovels out.
Right.
They don't stop shooting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, from what I know of trap shooters, that is absolutely true. Tyler, have you ever shot trap?
I have, and I'll be honest, I don't really love trap. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I just personally prefer, like, sporting clays, to Dan's point and to your point. I just, you know, it's a lot more fun. To me, you know, being every station, the presentations being different, and, you know, just, yeah, trap's fun, don't get me wrong, but I much prefer sporting clays personally.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I would agree with you. I think sporting clays, it's more fun. Like, it is just, it's interesting. You go to different stations, you can have fun with it. But I also think sometimes it's easy to get lost on the sporting clays course if you're, depending on what you're trying to get out of it. So, like, sometimes I'll go and shoot sporting clays and I'm shooting with, and this probably has to do with, like, my infrequency of shooting, but I'll go with guys that shoot weekly and they're kind of moving from station to station and they're doing their thing. And I'll kind of, like, I might go up there and miss a bunch of targets, and then it's just like we're moving on to the next station where I'd like to just, you know, I probably should be out there on my own or with one other person where we're, stop and stay at that station and let's work on this target that you just missed all three of, you know, that kind of thing. So I guess that's more my own doing, and I should carve out time to go about it a little bit differently if that's what I want to get out of it. But I do like the whole idea and concept of sporting clays. It's like the golf of clay shooting. It's pretty fun.
I would prefer sporting clays over trap. If I had a sporting clays range, it was 10 minutes from me and I could do it on Thursday nights, I'd probably be doing that. The cool thing about sporting clays is you can do that. You get your buddy and you guys make your own rules. You know, you shoot low gun. You don't yell pull. Your buddy releases a bird whenever he wants, kind of thing, or releases both birds, and just makes you, you know, have to get on that bird that much quicker.
Plus, just the trap,
you're up there with five
technique guys,
and you kind of got to do that.
What were we going to jump in with, Tyler?
I was going to say, just the consistency and technique and the presentation of birds, you know, you know, hold point, break point, all those different things. Like, if you're not consistent in it, your scores are just going to vary so dramatically, you know. And it's like, I shot maybe 3 weeks ago with my buddy Lenny, and I shot just like absolute garbage. And I don't know, like, I was just so inconsistent station to station. And the week before, I shot like an 80 on both courses with him. And it's like, I was riding high, you know, I'm like, I'm back in. I'm like, Lenny, I'm about to shoot a 90 this week. And I got my doors blown off the following week. It was so bad. But yeah, I mean, to Dan's point earlier about like target acquisition and all that, I mean, it's just so good. The repetition and muscle memory and practice you can get from it. The problem for him and I, for Dan and I, we got to drive, you know, an hour and a half north or an hour and a half south to get to a sporting clays range. Like, for whatever reason, by us, I don't know why, Dan. Maybe you know why, but there's none by us. It makes no sense.
It's New Jersey. Doesn't help.
Yeah.
Lots of trap clubs, and the trap clubs, most of them have skeet, five stand. Five stand's pretty cool. I like five.
I do as well. Yep. And there's something to be said about packing a lot of targets into a small footprint, right? Sporting clays, you kind of need some room, and you got to lay out a course, and so that obviously limits where you can pop one up. And a trap range can be set up in a much smaller footprint. You need one direction, basically, and put a couple of houses in there. So, yeah, I think we get all that. And I've got there's a couple of trap clubs around here, at least one I should pay a visit to. But we also have a really, really nice sporting clays course that's probably 20. I wish it was like 10 minutes away from my house. It's like 20, 25. But it's definitely worth going out there. So I'll be spending some time there. And they have everything. They have five stand and skeet and everything. So
I think my closest is 35 minutes. So
then it's a commitment, you know, and sporting clays are not inexpensive, and so you're driving there and gas and clays and ammo, and it's a bunch of upland hunters with a double gun addiction. You know, we don't need to, you know, we all know how expensive this stuff can get, but I wish our practice was cheaper sometime.
You ain't kidding.
yeah. Well, my excuse is on Thursday nights they serve dinner, so my wife doesn't have
to cook.
Two
for one.
Yeah.
That's odd. Well, we jumped right in here, and you guys are pals. You met on a hunt, right? Yeah. So let's dive in. Who wants to tell the story? Or maybe we should get both sides.
Yeah. Go for it, Dan. Go ahead.
I was trying not to let him run me over as he came flying down the dirt. I was just out basically for a walk with the shotgun on a pheasant stock property, you know. One of those things, got to get out. If you see a bird, try to get it to flush. If not, you know, pen pheasants they like to run. And I'm just walking back towards the truck, and this character pulled up and started talking to me and asked me if I wanted to hunt with him and his dog. So, it was a good time. His dog, Frankie, has a lot of potential, especially for the grouse woods. He just, he looks for the thickest stuff, and he just dives into it, which isn't something you can teach a dog.
Yeah. How long ago was that?
So November.
Yeah.
Probably. Oh, November, just this year. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
New
okay.
Best friends.
All right. All right.
Yeah. We jumped right in. Head over heels.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It was cool. We didn't get any birds, but you know, driving out of there, they're running back and forth in front of us across the road, of course, like they always
do. Yes, they were.
So that's crazy. New Jersey stocked pheasant site.
Yeah, we have a lot of them, a lot of spots. Down here where we are, South Jersey, we've got hundreds of thousands of acres of public hunting. The only issue is it's basically all the same. It's all pine trees.
Really?
You know? But they stock quail, pheasant.
They stock quail, too?
But there's...
Interesting.
Yeah,
so is it like pine plantation stuff, or like...
No, it's just natural. They call it the pine barrens.
Okay.
You know, and if you go to the northern part of the state, it's a complete opposite. You know, you got a lot of good-sized foothills, hardwoods, a lot of overgrown farmland, which is where I grew up. I grew up in the northwest part of the state. So coming down here, it's like the surface of the moon. It's just completely, I can't figure it out. Everything looks the same, you know?
Yep. Sand everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. But we don't have fire ants, which is a good thing.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Crazy.
All right. So could you, when you're walking in those pine barrens, do you ever flush a grouse, or is that like a unicorn never happening?
Not down here. Like growing up, I grew up on a dairy farm, and we had a lot of grouse. Okay. And I know that at one point in time, all of New Jersey was loaded with grouse, as were most places. But down here, now the last time I saw a grouse in New Jersey was in Sussex County. And that was one of the state forests up there. They closed our grouse season a couple of years ago.
Officially closed. Okay.
Yeah, for now. I mean, I do know that grouse are doing a little better than I think we had expected in some places, like Pennsylvania, New York. I think West Virginia is starting to get a little bit better from what I'm hearing. So hopefully New Jersey would come back.
It'd be amazing if it did.
If New Jersey, if the cover that is down here in the Pine Barrens is amazing. It's so thick in places. It's nothing but butternut. It's just bayberry everywhere. It's really like there's so much that's impenetrable. You're not going through it with Filson or anything on. You're just not going to get through it. So they would do good here, I would think. But, you know, we lost we had wild quail. Yep. We had wild pheasants at one time. It seems like a lot of things went downhill when when people stopped trapping. I think that's a huge part of it because there's just so many more predators on the ground. Raccoons, possums, skunks, foxes. Now we got coyotes. Yep. And I think that's been a big contributor to it.
I'm always curious, you know.
A lot of nest raiders.
Yeah, right. Yep. That's obviously a very common one. But I'm always curious talking to people from different areas, especially if you have something like that where the birds just aren't what they used to be. What's the theories, you know, that get passed around hunting camps and stuff? And that's certainly a common one. I kind of was asking because I have interviewed some New Jersey hunters before, Joel Pincala. And I remember when I was talking to him, I was enlightened to just how diverse of an upland variety New Jersey had with quail and woodcock and grouse and everything. Yep. So it's, there's sort of a rich history there, and I know it's not what it once was. And he talked to me quite a bit about grouse hunting, and I think where he was at, there were still a few grouse around, but I don't remember if that was pre or post the cancellation of the season.
There's probably still a few around up way up north. We got good rabbit hunting in a lot of places. I mean, throughout the state, there's a lot of rabbits. They're all over my yard here.
You ever chase those?
I hunted rabbits very, very seriously for many years. I lived in West Virginia for a little while, and that's really where I got heavily into grouse hunting. My uncle and a friend of his taught me how to hunt grouse without a dog, basically. Mm-hmm. And he and I hunted a lot of rabbits, and we would go rabbit hunting and shoot at grouse when we'd flush them, and it kind of reversed to go at grouse hunting and shoot at a rabbit if we'd flush it.
Yeah.
And when I came back to New Jersey, there really were not a huntable population, so to speak. So I got really, really into rabbit hunting. I wore out, I don't know how many pairs of Filson double tins doing that, wearing out muck boots, just kicking through raspberry and multiflora rose. At least one day a week, sometimes two, killed a lot of rabbits. And then, you know, work allowed, I started a job with a 4-day work week, and that's when I started getting more back into grouse hunting.
Okay.
Just looking online and stuff, and looking for properties, and things like that. Started hunting a lot in Pennsylvania, this is going back 15 years ago probably, and found some really good stuff. And then it just kind of, you know, then I started going to New York. And, you know, I've done some trips to Maine and Vermont, New Hampshire. But I love Pennsylvania. There's something about Pennsylvania. It's big woods. It's big timber. And there's a lot of just overgrown, a lot of what I call natural grouse habitat. Whether they're strip mines or there's a lot more places to hunt grouse than just clear cuts. Like New York, it's all clear cuts. If you're going to, for the most part, not everywhere, but a lot of New York grouse hunting is timber country. Or Pennsylvania, it's a little different. I would prefer Pennsylvania, but I find more birds in New York nowadays, so I spend more time there.
When he doesn't burn his PTO, so we can go out and play. But, you know, Dan burns all his PTO, so next fall is pretty much done for. So fails to mention
now, what are you burning your PTO on? That's not hunting, Dan.
I had the guy went down to Florida for a couple of weeks to help my mother out.
Oh, well, see, he throws in that he had to help his mother out, so he's, you know, it's like we can't really jab at him.
It was worth it.
Did you do any fishing down there?
So, no, not in Florida. Nope. Okay. Nope. Didn't have any time. Do tons of fishing here. I fish every waking moment. I fished up until the beginning of January this year, and I'll start up again probably the beginning of April. I only saltwater fish anymore. I do a little bit of fly fishing, but I've gone pretty much completely saltwater.
You weren't anywhere near
I'm 10 minutes.
Florida, were you?
No, I was about an hour north of Tampa.
I only ask because I'm going there in April, and I keep asking around. You know, I've actually talked to a couple people that are within striking distance in surrounding states, and been talking about turkey hunting, but
in Florida,
well. Or Alabama. I got some contacts in Alabama. But I think taking a day or two away from the family vacation to go turkey hunting is probably not a smart idea, but I can't help but ask.
Tell me
I would
I
love
be.
To know how you sell that. Please. Please keep me in the loop on how you sell that thing.
You take a light approach at the beginning, you kind of jokingly bring it up and you sort of gauge the response, and based on how those sarcastic pitches went, I don't think the reality is high there. But hey, you gotta keep trying.
You haven't been married very long, have you?
10 years, actually. 10 years. So I'm learning, Dan, but that's probably not very long in your book.
You'll never stop learning.
That's the plan, right?
Yeah. This year is my 15th. Okay. So I'm still learning too. I'm regularly putting my foot in my mouth.
Yeah.
You know, saying the wrong thing.
I love it. Tyler,
she's good about
how
it,
did you get into upland bird hunting and bird dogs? Because you're I would say you've reached fanatical level, and I don't know that it's taken you very long. So I respect that.
I mean, so we got Frankie during, or maybe the end of COVID. Yeah, end of COVID.
Okay.
And, you know, I would just be out and about with him all the time, and people would always
Frankie's a short hair, right?
That dog. Yeah, Frankie's a short hair. You know, full transparency, we bought him from a place that I probably wouldn't buy another dog from. You know, made all the first time owner mistakes, and that's okay. He's a great dog. It's worked out in the end, right? But people would always press me, are you going to hunt with this dog? You going to hunt with this dog? And I really wanted to, but I didn't really have any resources. Like, you know, we live here at the beach, at the shore. A lot of people around here in my friend circle, they don't hunt, right? So I didn't really have anybody to lean on. Like, I wanted to do it, but I was kind of scared, you know? So I just, like, ventured onto Facebook and some of the short hair groups, and I was, like, trying to find people in Jersey and PA, and stumbled upon a group, and luckily I found a couple old-timers that had pigeons that they trained every week, and so I just went out there one Sunday. An hour and 20 minute drive every Sunday. But and it was like, you know, once I saw Frankie on birds and it was just like, I really like this. And then it was like, I think, and Dan could probably tell you, like, I'm not afraid to like fall forward and make mistakes, right? And learn as I go. And so call it stupid, you know, I think it's a good thing. And just like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to go all in.
Yeah.
Right. So My first hunt was actually with Frankie. My first ever hunt was grouse hunting, right? Got my ass kicked. I got sick. It was 85 degrees in Vermont. Tons of bird exposure. Like,
were you by yourself?
That's a whole different story.
Yes, he was.
Yes. Well, I met a guy on Facebook who's got great setters. His setters are phenomenal. And so I went out with him. It was I think 8.5 or 9 hour drive with Frankie. That was the first time he'd ever been in a car that long. And we were up in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. It was incredible. I think you and I spoke about it a little while ago. I mean, they don't really manage the forests all that well, so it's just absolutely punishing cover. And it was like the most humbling experience, right? And I look back on it now and it's like, for your first hunt, that may not be like the first the first one you go in, maybe you do like a, you know, a stock hunt or something like that, just to get your feet wet, not, you know, go all out and do a grouse hunt. But I look back on it and it was just like amazing, you know, because it was so humbling that I'm like, I gotta go and succeed at this thing now after getting my ass kicked for two full days.
Yeah. But I don't know, man, maybe it doesn't seem like the best thing, but then again, here you are, you know.
Yeah, spot on.
So what year was that? Obviously after that COVID, was
this fall. Yeah, so Frankie was, I think, 17 months on our first hunt. So I was a little bit late getting him trained,
because you weren't really you weren't thinking about it.
Yeah, no, I wasn't at all, but it's worked out. And then I stumbled upon this guy walking by himself with a beat up tin cloth Orvis vest and a side by side, and I'm like,
legit.
Yeah, something about this guy, like, I gotta pull over and just talk to him, right? And so we got to talking, and I'm like, well, you know, I don't normally do this, but I was thinking about putting my short hair down if you want to run with us or whatever. And he's like, yeah, sure. He's like, I've been chasing this pheasant for like 45 minutes, just been running around the damn WMA. It's like, all right, let's go get it. And, you know, like 2 minutes in, Dan's like, you know, let's skip the field. Like, let's get the thick stuff over here. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. And I think we trailed the bird for like 45 minutes. Frankie was all over it. And we didn't, I think we flushed and it flew away to the other side of the field. And then I had to go because I had something going on. We're driving out. It's this beautiful rooster just sitting in the middle of the field. I pull over. I call Dan. I was like, you better go flush that bird. Like, I got to go. Go get that bird. And, of course, he didn't get it. But it's okay.
Hey, it disappeared. There was another one, too. I couldn't. It's so thick down here in places. They just disappear. And these pen birds, they're athletes. They just run and run. It's very hard to get them to fly. You almost absolutely need a dog to get them to fly.
Yeah. I tell you what, though, Nick, like, even though they're stocked, like, we do have wild woodcock, which I'm going to target more next fall with Frankie. I'll be honest with you, the most unexpected thing for me this fall was, like, quail. Like, quail have, like, stole my heart. Like, I really want to go target wild quail. There's something about them. It's just, like, mesmerizing watching them, you know? They're just so beautiful, so fast. Just love them.
Yeah, I would say I've never been on a wild quail hunt, so I have to say that straight out. But I, like you, and I got a step closer in that I did some Johnny House quail when I was on my way back from South Carolina. It is sort of actually getting to put boots on the ground in quail like cover, and getting some dog work and getting a chance to shoot at some birds. It kind of like it makes it easier to then visualize, you know, like the wild quail hunt, what that might be like. And yeah, they're neat little birds. And I don't have a ton of experience on covey flush birds, and obviously that's a whole different thrill in and of itself. Just another thing to make you come unglued as a wing shooter.
Oh yeah, add it to the list.
Exactly.
Which one do I shoot?
Yeah. That's I can still remember the first covey of huns that I shot at. It was not proud of it, but it was a total, just like, it was a huge covey, so that maybe had something to do with it. But I like accidentally knocked one down because it was an awful shot.
Where was that at?
Yeah.
What state was that?
That would have been North Dakota, a few years ago. Dan, how did you?
And they're fast.
Yeah, they're fast, and they're fast and they're hardy. I think again, somebody that hunts them a lot more would have. Be able to say, but they're like, it's like a bird, like if it comes down, I mean, they're small, so you kind of think of, you know, knock one down, maybe I'm used to hunting grouse so much that, you know, they're fairly easy. If you make a good shot, it's coming down and it's probably not going anywhere, whereas a hun, man, they just got that, like, a will to, like, hide. And you need a good dog to make recoveries on those, from what I have seen. But Dan, how did you get into hunting?
Well, growing up on a farm, everybody around me hunted, you know, uncles, cousins, second cousins. All I wanted to do was be with them. And I was tagging along from the time I was probably 8. And I think when I was 11, my grandfather got me a Crescent single shot 12 gauge hammer gun. And he gave me a box of number 2 high brass and said, go kill groundhogs, get out of my hair. And I remember I couldn't pull the hammer back on the gun.
Stiff.
So I went back to him. I'm like, Pop, I can't get the hammer back. And he put it in the vise. He was a machinist. He put it in the vise. He took a file. He filed some grooves in it, and it was off to the races. Ended up cracking the stock on that gun, but killed a boatload of groundhogs.
You think it had anything to do with those number two high brassers?
Oh, let me tell you. Oh, yeah. Yep. He actually bought this was 1985, 86 probably. He bought a Mech 600 Junior and started reloading for me. Which is now that's when I load all my short chamber 12 gauge and, you know, my Sporting Clays loads. I load them on that machine. Still works like a charm. All the paint's worn off.
That's
of it.
Cool.
He had a Lefevre side by side. I killed my first deer with that.
Buckshot?
I killed tons of squirrels. Yes. Yep. Number one buckshot.
Wow.
Believe it or not. In a cornfield. Yep. My uncle that taught me to grouse hunting, he had a restocked JP Sauer 12 gauge. I think it's a Royal. Really nice gun. He had a beautiful piece of like grade 5 walnut put on.
Wow.
And that kind of got my side by side craze going. But I was always a Model 37 guy. So
that's the Ithaca, right?
As I got further, you know, as I got back into grouse hunting, like I said, about 15 years ago, the side-by-side thing is when I really started going nuts with them. The first one I bought was a JP Sauer. Went from there, and it was this constant search for the perfect side-by-side. It's a rabbit hole. It's an absolute rabbit hole. But I think I'm pretty well set now. I think I finally figured out what I like. If I buy another side-by-side, it'll probably be an English gun, another English gun. I had a few in the past. 30-inch 12-gauge for one, which was 6.5 pounds I never should have sold. But if I buy another, I have a fair eyesight, or Isidé, they pronounce it.
I've been saying that wrong for a long time.
Ended my search. Yeah. Well, that gun kind of ended the search. I mean, it's so perfect in every way, and they're so versatile. 3-inch 20-gauge, you know, choke tubes. Not really my preference, but it just works. I kill birds with it. I've got some other side by sides.
Yeah.
Where's that JP Sauer with grade 5 though? Where does this come from? This is coming out of left field here.
Yeah, that's in my 82-year-old uncle's safe in West Virginia.
Locked up far away from Tyler.
Yeah. Nick, you're pulling all this stuff out of him. What I want to know is those number twos. How much would a box of number twos back then cost?
Oh, probably about $4.
Nickel a piece or something.
God.
Yeah, let me tell you, I could have killed deer with them if I wanted to. They were stout. I mean, full choke, I was killing groundhogs at 60 yards with that gun. Oh, yeah. And they didn't go far. Years later, I realized that number twos were illegal. Here I am, 11 years old, running around the
Dad gave them to
New
me.
Jersey. Yeah.
So you've just confessed to a crime? Is that what you're saying on the podcast?
That's got to be statute
probably
of limitations
several hundred
on that,
times. I killed 21 groundhogs in one day, and my grandfather said he didn't believe me, and he's like, "You bring me a tail from a groundhog, I'll give you a shotgun shell." So he started me out with another box. The next day, I brought him 23 groundhog tails, and he—that's when he bought the reloader.
Yeah,
I got really good at sneaking up on him in the hay field. Like you could see the hay moving, and just sneak up on him, and sometimes get between them and their hole, and they just kind of stand there and look at you. You know? Horrible thinking about
right,
it. Now,
right, right, right. Yeah, but Grandpa put you to work, man. That's good stuff.
Yeah, he was so mad he had to go buy me another box of shotgun shells.
Now we got to call you out there. Quickly, Dan, you did say, if I buy another side-by-side. I mean, that we all know that.
Well, you know, my wife is in the other room.
All right,
so.
Fair enough.
I really like 16-gauge. Yep. I like fixed chokes. I like an English grip. I don't mind 26-inch barrels, which everybody, the big fad now is 30-inch barrels, longer barrels. I have a 16-gauge Trojan that was cut back to 26 inches, and it's just... I don't know. The way a fixed choke side-by-side, the way the barrels taper, I would prefer fixed chokes. But, yeah, 26 to 28-inch, you know, 6-pound, 16-gauge with an English grip. And there's even some 12 gauges out there that I wouldn't turn my nose up at. You know, the English gun makers just did such a good job with balance and, you know, thin wall thicknesses, yet, you know, still 1/8 oz, 1¼ oz proof. And they really had the American gun manufacturers beat in many ways. Although there's a few, I mean, you know, the Foxes, depending on what weight barrels you get, the Parkers, mm-hmm. depending on the frame, the O-frame, but I've seen 6.5 lb O-frame 16 gauges.
Have you
I've
really?
Seen 5¾ lb O-frame 16 yeah. gauges. So it's all, you got to judge each one on its own merit, as they say.
It doesn't tell you, Nick, because there's probably like 3 in his safe full of shotguns. You know, that's like 20 deep that he could sell to get his dream shotgun, but he won't.
There's a few, and there's nothing in there worth selling.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and friend of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's a hard thing. Well, I guess at this point, I could say that I understand how gun collections form, because it's just... It's easier to buy them than it is to let them go, I guess, for a lot, or it seems like for a lot of people, myself included at this point. But I got to figure out how to move some of them.
How many you have?
Oh, you can't ask me that, Tyler.
Oh, I got to know, because now it's a point of reference when my wife says, no, when my wife says,
that's
you need
why
another
you
shotgun, I could say, listen, I'm like way under indexing.
Right, right. Well, I guess if it's to help you out like that, I mean, like we're double digits at least, right?
Oh my God. My God.
Not nearly enough of them are getting used. You know, in my mind, if you came over to my place and you pointed at each one, I could without even thinking about it, I could roll off some justification, some line that I've some story I've told myself why it's sitting there, but yeah, that's I gotta look in the mirror one of these days.
I respect it.
Don't get too crazy yet, Tyler. And like they say, be very aware of the man with one gun.
Yes, yes.
Dan, I only got two. I got a field gun and I got my Clay's gun. That's it.
Yeah. And that your bird gun is like, I mean, it's not so much something I would, not that I wouldn't choose, but it's like the perfect bird gun.
Well, that's till August when my shiny new toy comes in. Then that's my perfect one.
You know, Nick had mentioned that there's like a 12-month wait now that just happened.
It's okay. It's okay. I'll just borrow your fare if I have to.
There's a lot of stuff to chew on there. Dan, it is funny, the barrel thing, you know, barrel length definitely sort of like goes in and out of vogue, because there was definitely a time where short barrels were all the rage, and now Admittedly, long barrels are very seemingly very trendy, and I've talked about them plenty, and I've sort of transitioned to shooting those. A lot of my perception is kind of skewed a little bit just by, you know, the fact that, like, if you can build a gun and you can choose what barrel length, you know, I'm always trying to weigh, like, you know, why would you make them shorter or longer in that way? And I take into consideration a lot, like when I'm talking to customers, like, you know, the stature of the shooter, what's your length of pull, what are you trying to get out of it? And it's just kind of, I don't know, it's fun to work through those things. But when you go to the vintage world, you know, if you want to rule out short barrels, you're going to rule out a lot of guns. You know, there's a lot of great, great guns that have good balance and good weights that have 26-inch barrels. And I would say there's nothing inherently wrong with those guns. You find a night, I mean, I've shot some of them. There's some good deals out there on those guns.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and a lot of it's balance. You fit and balance.
Yep.
You know, and like I said earlier, the English gun makers really nailed that.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the Spanish guns, you know, but even like look at the SKBs, they were spectacular little shotguns.
Do you have one of those?
Even though I don't like single triggers, right. They're pretty much bomb proof. They balance good. They're really well made. But you can almost get them for a song because, like, you look at the 25 inch ones. So many of them were 25 inch.
Yep.
Now that's definitely short, but all the 28 inches are modified in full, so you're gonna have to open the chokes
right.
up on them, you know. But I think 90% of it is the way that gun balances and how you pull at the shoulder. I think that makes so much more difference than that extra 2 inches of barrel length.
Yeah. In the priority list of what goes into it, you know, there's fit, there's balance, and somewhere down that list, you're going to get to weight on the scale. You know, weight on the scale, I feel like, is oftentimes too high on the priority list for a lot of people, because if you, and you'll know this, like if you pick up two guns that weigh exactly the same thing on the scale, they could have dramatically different feel and handling characteristics. So you kind of got to take into
Absolutely.
Consideration the whole package versus that simple number on the scale. That doesn't tell the whole story.
Absolutely. Yep. That little Trojan I have, that 6 pounds, 5 ounces. My fare is 5 pounds, 10 ounces, and I prefer to carry the Trojan. It just feels better. There's just something about it.
Nick, I'd be curious, like, because you've been with UGC now, what, how many?
Three, years? About three.
Is there any, have there been any things that, like, really stick out that weren't, like, as popular when you started to now? Like, anything that's becoming pretty much, like, guarantee on every gun now?
Like, you mean, like, trends from customers?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I would say we definitely, you know, long barrels, like we definitely see that specifically in the lightweight side by sides, which I think there's definitely something. I mean, we have that conversation a lot with if you've got a long length of pull, and we're doing custom stocks too, so you know, we're not making production guns that have the same length of pull for everybody. So if you have a long length of pull and you're building a really lightweight Venus 28 gauge, we're definitely going to talk to you about long barrels and how that gun is going to feel and handle. So we see that a lot because we build lots of sub-gauge side-by-sides. I mean, certainly side-by-sides are doing well, and sub-gauges, I don't think that's certainly not new within the last 3 years, but, you know, everybody's all over the 28 gauge right now. That's for sure. And I've shot it enough to understand why, but yeah, it is interesting to sort of see the trends come, and I haven't been around long enough to see any go and then maybe come back around, but it's something I'll be curious about over the years.
Yeah, I had two 30-inch 28 gauge side by sides, and they're just, I think that is like the perfect setup. You know, the bigger the gauge, I think the shorter the barrel you can get
right.
away with.
Right, I would agree with that.
26-inch 12 gauge. 28 gauge, definitely. You start getting down to 28-inch barrels, you're getting pretty whippy. 30-inch, the two I had were Dickinson's.
Okay, yep.
I had issues with them, but, boy, they just, the balance was excellent on them.
Yeah, and I feel like it's sometimes counterintuitive. Just like you kind of like go down and gauge, you think about building a smaller gun, but it's actually, you really want to consider lengthening the barrels as you go down and gauge and frame and profile and everything. At least
absolutely,
that's what I've done. I've had real good success with it, and we've had many conversations with the likes of Del Whitman and other wing shooting instructors and stuff that tend to back that up. So
what about fixed chokes? You get a lot of people ordering fixed
chokes. I would say that's if I had to just go back of the napkin, I'd say 50-50. A lot of people recognize that, you know, because interchangeable choke tubes are pretty much a standard option on most new shotguns. There's not a whole lot out there that have fixed chokes anymore, but we give that option because if our customers don't want them, you don't have to pay for them. That's kind of how our whole model works. So I would say it's about 50-50. People that just know they are basically a two choke person and they don't even want to bother changing them, and they know what they can use, and they know they can use ammunition and shot size and patterning to alter their patterns even with fixed chokes. So they'll build fixed chokes and save some money on that, maybe put it in a nicer piece of wood. And then there's other people that are just purely looking for that additional versatility that choke tubes provide. And in, you know, in that case, like, you're building a gun and it's the $450, while not inexpensive, it's a marginal cost for somebody wanting to build a gun that just has that choke tube versatility. So we see a real good mix of that. And I would say it's the same with ejectors versus extractors too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to know you can order a new gun with fixed chokes. Because if I were to go that route, it would definitely be fixed chokes.
What would you choke it?
I'd like to say IC mod, but possibly both IC. But I do like cylinder. Yep. It'd probably be like an O2 constriction and an O5, something like that. I just think that fixed choke barrels are completely different than choke tube barrels. They balance different. The way they taper at the muzzle end, I think they look better even, you know. Tyler will, he'll see.
Nick, now you understand why. It's like, it's like the two people on the shoulder. I had Dan on one shoulder and then like Mike on my other shoulder saying like which way to go. And then I got Dan telling me which way to go. And it's like, what do? You know,
you got the little guys on the shoulders, and one's saying buy the boat, and the other one's saying and the truck to tow it with.
Yeah, that's basically what it was like. There was nobody saying don't do it.
Yeah.
What's your hunting gun, right? Because you mentioned that you before we got carried away there, with the gun collection. I will say that since I have started shooting my side by side that are properly fit for me, and after working with Dell and building some gun, like, I have only killed birds with one shotgun for the last two seasons, and I basically refuse to carry anything else just because I appreciate that I shoot that one gun very well. I have a lot of confidence with it. I don't really have any interest in messing around too much and shooting guns that I'm not going to be as good with. So that's why I say, like, I have some guns that probably don't need to be here anymore, but we'll cross that bridge when we get there. But I definitely like shooting, having confidence in a gun, shooting it a lot. And so you're certainly not in a bad spot there, Tyler. And with that in mind, I was curious, what's your sporting clay gun, and then what is your hunting gun at the moment?
Well, I'm going to make you laugh here. So my sporting clay's gun is a 30-inch Silver Pigeon 1 sport. And then my field gun is a Silver Pigeon 3 20-gauge field. But you'll laugh because, like, this is how naive I was, and I probably shouldn't admit this because I will totally get roasted, but I don't care. I didn't have a mentor. Like, my uncle was an upland bird hunter, but he had passed away like by the time I had already taken this on, so like I didn't have somebody to really to, like, you know, piggyback some of my crazy ideas off of. So I got the Silver Pigeon 3, a sporting clays gun, thinking like, oh, I can hunt with this thing. It's 12 gauge. It's only like 30 pounds, right? So I had gotten an adjustable comb and recoil pad put on from PMS Firearms down in North Carolina. And so I went up to Griffin Howe in North Jersey, got fitted for it, which is, you know, when I say the dimensions for my gun. And so I took that up with me to Vermont for my first ever hunt with Frankie. It's, you know, got the adjustable recoil pad on it that adds like whatever, you know, 3-4 inches. And so it's like I'm trucking through the brush and everywhere this thing is getting stuck on branches and I'm having to like pull my gun. It also weighs like 10 pounds. And like when I tell you I got my ass kicked, that's why I got my ass kicked. It was so heavy, getting stuck on everything. And I came back from that trip and I told my wife, I was like, Courtney, I need to buy like another shotgun. And she's like, why do you need another shotgun?
You already have
one. What's wrong with the one you got? Yeah, exactly. I was like, Courtney, you just don't even understand. Like, I was so defeated, you know? So that's what I shoot now in the field is my Silver Pigeon 3, which is great. It's a little too short for me. It got absolutely abused, though. I mean, I should actually give it to Dan to have him do some work on the wood. The wood is so scuffed up and just beat up from this fall. It's insane.
Well,
leave it just like it is. It tells a story.
Yeah.
Yeah, that means you were putting some boot leather down and using it. So that's what it should be.
Or Frankie was chewing on it, which is completely...
Probably.
Yeah, any bite marks on
there? Or just ranging through nasty cover that I'm like, you know, looking on my handheld, always 70 yards up, and it's like, Frankie, how the heck did you get through this stuff? And then I'm just hiking to get to him. And actually, Nick, you'll laugh at this. Well, you won't laugh at this. My Alpha 200 bricked yesterday. Uh-oh. So I got to wait for my new one to come
in. What happened to it? Just...
So I was out at the public wildlife yesterday area just doing some training with my dogs. You know, it's off season, so I'm trying to tighten them up. And it's got 50% battery. I got the dogs on the ground and I had turned it on before I put the collars on. And so they're out just doing their thing while I get all my stuff together. And I look down and the handheld's off. And I'm like, what the heck? I got 50% battery. Why is it off? Turn it back on. 2 minutes later, it turns off again. I'm like, what the heck is going on here? Like the screen brightness is at the lowest. So it's not the screen brightness app in the battery and it's still got 50%. I turn it on again. Turns off again. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to try the hard reset. I hard reset it. Then I got like solid black lines through the screen and it wouldn't turn
on. How do you hard
on.
Reset the Alpha?
It's the buttons on the right-hand side. So it was like the top one and the enter button.
It's kind of like an iPhone sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then I called Garmin and they're going to replace it. Nice. I tried squeezing them for an Alpha 300. You know, I was like, can I get an upgrade? They're like, no, we don't do that.
Like, oh man. I just saw my buddy Rayhan at Pheasant Fest. He works for Garmin. You should messaged me. Maybe not that he could have done anything, but he probably would have.
I would have overnighted that thing. I would have overnighted that thing to you for a 300i.
Well, that's good. They're replacing. I haven't heard about that too much. I mean, those things are from everything. You know, in my experience, I've been using them really since I had Artley. So I guess 10 years now. I've had a Garmin GPS handheld, and for a high tech piece of technology, I would describe them as very reliable. But
yeah, I love it. And I just started having issues where it was like dropping signal on the collars. And that was kind of like the first thing in my mind is like something maybe might be up with it. And then it just happened. I was furious.
Right.
But they were really cool. Yeah. They replaced
That's
it.
Good.
So, yeah.
I just need a 2-minute intermission. I'll be right back.
All right.
Don't go anywhere.
We'll be here.
Dan, your hair looks great. So how was Pheasant Fest?
Pheasant Fest was awesome. It was just... I don't know. It feels like a whirlwind at this point. I got home 2 days ago and I got down there Wednesday. We set up Thursday setup day. It was nice, stress-free, you know, got there a day early basically. So was able to get the Upland Gun Company booth set up with everybody. And we had, as I mentioned a few times on intros and stuff to the show, we had a joint booth with Final Rise and Onyx Hunt. And from there, it was they kicked off the show with a Trampled by Turtles concert on Thursday night. That was an absolute blast. And then Pheasant Fest started at noon on Friday. And man, the rest of the weekend, I felt like all I was doing was shaking hands, saying hi to familiar faces and new faces, and talking shotguns and bird dogs for like 3 days straight. I mean, it was an absolute blast.
That's awesome. So what about new gear? Because I'm a gear junkie, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, you and about a lot of people listening. Man, it's one of the things I always have a hard time taking time away from the Upland Gun Company booth to like go walk around the show, even though like I mean it's sort of twofold. Like I would love to go cruise around and look at everything, but then in the back of my mind I also know like it's probably better for my wallet to just stay put and keep on talking to people about shotguns. So I ran over to the Crispy booth. I was talking to those guys, kind of like, I love my, I'll use these Laponia, crispy Laponia boots. They have a new version of those coming out that sound kind of neat. They're pretty much the same thing I've got with a few upgrades. So like, I didn't feel like I needed to buy them on the spot, but I love those boots. So I was over talking to those guys. The Final Rise, do you have a Final Rise vest? Okay.
Yeah. Yep, and Sidekick bag.
All right. Yeah, good for you. They had some new color schemes, and they're working on like a custom shop coming up, which sounds really, really cool.
Oh,
yep,
that's cool.
And they've got their hoodies and their brush pants. So I saw a lot of those because we were right next to them the whole weekend. But long story short, I didn't like cruise the entire show floor to check out like any new hot new items. So I'm kind of drawing a blank on that.
Yeah. Gotcha.
But it was, as I mentioned, Pheasants Forever and Quill Forever, they put on a great show for exhibitors and also the attendees and all of the, it's a real big kind of a thank you to the chapter members, chapter leaders, and see a lot of those folks there year after year, kind of getting recognition at some of the dinners and banquets and obviously all the work that PF and QF does. So it's just it's a really a first class event, and I've been to a handful of them now, and I would absolutely go out of my way to go to one because they do a really great job with them.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'll be in Sioux Falls in October, actually.
Really?
And October next fall. One of the guys when I'm not hanging out with Dan, my other buddy that I met, who has an incredible short hair, she just turned a year, he has a house in Sioux Falls, so we're going to go out and hunt next fall, which I'm pumped because I cannot wait to get after sharptails and obviously some pheasant and, you know, just some of the other species out there. I'm so excited for that. We're going to road trip that. So that's going to be a hike for us.
Man, you'll have to let me know because, yeah, I just made that drive and that, well, you'll be swinging through this part of the world. So we'll have to keep in touch on that.
For sure. What'd you say, Dan?
And why wasn't I invited?
You don't have days. Remember, we're saving your days to go up to the Catskills to chase grouse.
Who's a better shot, Dan or your other buddy?
You know, actually, Brett will be super pissed when he listens to this when I say that Dan's a better shot, as much as it pains me. Well, lately, Brett's been on the money. The first couple times we went out, you know, he was using a different – because he changes – it's like Dan. He's got like 12 shotguns. So every time we go out, he uses a new shotgun, so it's never consistent. But the first couple times we went out, you know, he missed a couple of times. But then we did a preserve hunt 2 weeks ago on quail just to work on our dogs. And I don't think he missed the entire day. My shooting, on the other hand, we're not even going to go down that path. But, yeah, he shot great. But, yeah, I mean, Dan's a great shot. I'm not even going to lie. As much as I'd love to roast him, Dan's a good shot.
Dan, if you –
until I step into the grouse with
him. Oh, well, that, yeah, good. That's the segue because I was going to say, if you're going on the grouse hunt tomorrow, what shotgun would you take and why? Yeah.
Me? For me, grouse hunting is a drive for me, so I always take at least two shotguns. But it's always – I have a Model 37 that I really like, but I don't use it as much. It's normally my Trojan or my Fair. A lot of the time it's a Trojan. It's too short for me. It's got too much drop, but it just works. It just feels – It's a true one-handed shotgun. Like when you're pushing through cover, it's right there. It's all about the feel, right? I mean,
20 gauge Trojan.
I kill birds with it.
16. Okay.
Yep.
Nick, you better be careful. You're bringing up a really sensitive subject with shotgun, Dan.
You mean the 20 gauge versus 16 gauge?
Oh yeah.
Well, I had it in my notes.
So I'm a bit of a purist. I like the nostalgia. But, I mean, it's tough to beat the versatility of a 20-gauge. Yep. But you know, I mean, if I could only have one bird gun and one load the rest of my life, it'd be a 16-gauge and number sevens.
16 number sevens. I could get on board with that. I am by no means a 16-gauge hater, not at all. I like to say I did drink the purple Kool-Aid, the 16-gauge Kool-Aid for a little while, and I still have my Fox Sterlingworth. And, you know, it's just funny because I just think right now, and again, I work for a company that manufactures new modern shotguns. In the vintage world, the 16 gauge really was and still is a sweetheart. The Sweet 16. It's just, I mean, there's some 16 gauges out there that are just fantastic. And at that time, we didn't have the same modern ammunition criteria that we do today, where today 12 and 20 gauge kind of lead the charge because of supply and demand. And I mean, as you guys know, like, you can shoot an ounce of load out of an ounce of shot, out of a 12. You can shoot it out of a 16. You can shoot it out of a 20. Hell, you can shoot it out of a 28. And it's just, gauge is a little bit less relevant to me today than it was. And so I always look at it like, again, like that versatility thing. If you're trying to build the most versatile, there's something to be said about a 3-inch interchangeable choked 20 gauge, not by any fault of the 16 gauge, simply just because of the ammunition availability and what you can do with that. That's kind of how I look at it, at least now.
Actually, this year, 16 gauge ammo has been easier to get than 20 gauge
in
field loads.
I feel like there's been a resurgence too, as far as like what you can actually find and buy. And when you're shooting 16, do you only shoot 1 ounce or less, or do you shoot anything heavier than 1 ounce?
Rarely will I shoot heavier than 1 ounce. I feel like 12 gauge is ounce and an eighth, 16 is an ounce, 20 gauge is 7/8, and 28 gauge is 3/4. And once you start pushing past that, then you lose the effectiveness. I think you start to deform your shot. You start to lose your pattern quality. These high velocity loads. I mean, granted, if you're out on the prairie and you're killing pheasants at 40 plus yards, you know, you need big shot. You need fours and fives. Morris Baker at RST, I talked with him extensively about that particular topic. And I asked him why his ammo is so good. At Hausman's Hidden Hollow up in Friendsville, PA, with that Trojan, I was breaking clay targets at 50 yards with that gun. And he's the one that kind of explained it to me, that those, you know, 1,100 foot per second, 6,500 pound loads, they patterned perfectly for the most part. And, you know, good hard shot is a big part of that.
Yeah, you need good components.
That's why I think that low velocity Winchester AA target ammo, you know, is an excellent grouse load. So
less is more. Less is more. I think, you know, again, it's like conceptually, I totally agree with you as far as like payloads and stuff. And as we've talked about it many times on this podcast, like with modern WAD technology and good quality components, you can get away, like you can get into the fringes a little bit. You can up the payload here and there as needed. But I'm always like trying to anchor myself in the, all right, I got a 28 gauge. I'm gonna shoot 3/4 ounce loads first before I feel like I have to go shoot 7/8 or 1 ounce, or, you know. And if you are experimenting, you know, don't just default to that. Start with the standard payload and see what it can do before you feel like you have to push bigger, faster, stronger. I think that's where you can get sidetracked a little bit.
I have a friend that kills, you know, they're pen raised pheasants, but he kills them with 3/4 ounce 28 gauge, very consistently. He doesn't lose any birds. I mean, they hit the ground dead.
I'm not surprised by that at all. 3/4 ounce
RST. Yeah. Yep. And there's some longer shots, 30, 35 yards. He's just pummeling these birds with a 28 gauge, 3/4 ounce. So when people say you need an ounce and a quarter to kill pheasants, I just kind of shake my head.
Yeah.
You know, it comes down to choke at that point. I'd rather shoot an ounce of 16 out of a full choke at pheasants than an ounce and a quarter in a 12 gauge.
Tyler, is your head spinning?
Yeah, I was going to say. No, because I was going to say, it's funny you guys were talking about, you know, the loads, because even, you know, when I was, because I was aggressively shooting sporting clays just to get all the reps in the off season, you know, and I was going with the competition AA loads, you know, 1250, 1300 feet per second, ounce and an eighth. And I just went back to like 1 ounce loads, and I much, much prefer shooting 1 ounce loads, even on the sporting clays course,
right,
which And actually, Dan, this will upset Dan a little bit, but I'll be honest with you. I was shooting Fiocchi Crusher loads last month. They were 1 ounce loads. They were like, I think, 1,300 feet per second. And I loved them. They were great. Like, you know, granted, it was a higher feet per second, but the 1 ounce loads, I don't think I'll ever shoot above a 1 ounce load again shooting sporting clays.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't need it.
Especially if you're not competing, right? I mean, yeah.
No.
It's less wear and tear on you, less wear and tear on the gun. And again, that's the place to go and build the confidence in shooting that 1 ounce load or that 7/8 ounce payload. You see what it can do at those ranges and on those targets. Like you can knock a grouse down at 25 yards.
Yeah, if you look at RST's website, I mean, they've got 7/8 ounce 12 gauge.
Yep.
And I know a lot of guys that use those. They love them. So
I think after my experience...
Hey, you got to pattern your gun.
Yeah, you do. You do. That's
a huge part.
Nobody does enough of that. Myself included, you know, my hand is raised over here.
Me too. Yep. I'm the worst about it.
But yeah, I think after my experience the last two seasons, primarily shooting 3/4 ounce of 8.5 shot on grouse, let's say all of a sudden I magically woke up and Del Whitman had restocked my Fox Sterlingware so I could shoot it again, I'd probably go to RST and do they make 7/8 ounce 16 gauge?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd go buy 7/8 ounce of 8-shot and just and go pattern them like I should. The pellet count at the ranges that I'm shooting at, and I want the pellet count, and I know that I don't need more than that, and I don't want to shoot more than I need, and I think that would be a really, really good, effective and efficient patterning load, especially out of a 16-gauge bore.
Do you get a lot of... birds hitting the ground and running with those number eights?
I really don't. Not any more than when I was shooting 7.5s.
So, Nick, I got a question for you. Do you have like a list of states and species that are, whether it's bucket list or not, that are like on your list that you really, really want to get to?
I would not much more than, I'm not too specific in my dream hunts at this point, other than I'd love to go do an authentic wild bobwhite quail hunt. And you know, the quail species are the ones that I haven't really experienced, whether it be the Southwest or the Western, and then chucker. You know, I mean, I doing this podcast, like I've talked to people that have pretty much done it all, so my curiosity is always piqued about, like, I'd like to do a real chucker hunt, I'd like to do a real quail hunt. I still haven't done a whole lot of pheasant hunting. I'm pretty happy to do my grouse hunting around here, but I would love to do it all. I just haven't made a point to do that yet.
I could spend every last day of my life in the grouse woods and be happy.
Yeah, it doesn't take much more than that. You know, you give me an afternoon and some nice conditions, and I'm happy driving out to a new spot and going for a walk in the grouse. You know, that's part of it. I will take advantage of that as much as possible.
Yeah.
How often do you run into people when you're out there, Nick?
It's pretty unusual, I would say. I mean, I'm very lucky to live in an area that has a lot of public land, and I think if you do see somebody, I just keep driving. You know, like I don't ever really feel a need. If there's a truck parked at a spot that I was going to, I'm backing out and going somewhere else because I have that luxury. I don't even have to think about going into the woods near somebody else. You know, if I'm going to bump into somebody out there, it's probably going to be like a bow hunter or somebody else. It just, it doesn't happen all that often, which, again, that's a good, I'm very lucky to have that opportunity.
Yeah, no, you definitely are.
I imagine it's not anywhere near that way for you guys out east.
Well, it depends where you go.
Yeah.
Now, you're in Minnesota, right? Yeah, I have spots in Pennsylvania where I never see other grouse hunters.
That's good.
New York's a little different. But yeah, I've got places in Pennsylvania where I'm the only one there. Might be a bow hunter around, but I'm the only bird hunter.
Till next fall.
You like 7, 7.5, Dan, shot size?
I do. I kind of prefer a bigger pellet. I think bigger pellets plow through brush a little better. They're less likely to be, deflected or deformed. Going through leaves or whatnot. Yep. With grouse, you need one pellet. One pellet in the right place, and that bird's done. Not like a pheasant. which pheasants, you almost need a machine gun at times to kill pheasants. I've never seen such a tough bird in my life.
Yeah.
I have puffballed pheasants at 15, 20 yards, and they fell to the ground motionless, and I walk over there, and there's no bird. It's happened to me enough times where they're like armored. But grouse, one or two pellets in the right place. I've actually skinned grouse that didn't have a single pellet, and I had to go look, and then there was one pellet in the neck, one in the head.
Yeah.
They die pretty easy, but I think that those little bit bigger pellets just have a more tendency to get where you want them to go. But, you know, like you said, there's a higher pellet count. What's their 600 number as opposed to 400?
Yeah, so like, in a, I know in the, because prior to that, I was shooting a lot of 1 ounce of 7.5s, and that's 350. And in my 3/4 ounce of 8.5s, which I will say, like, if I was shooting any gauge larger than 28, I don't think I would go below 8 because I wouldn't feel a need. But in that 28, that 3/4 ounce payload, you go to 8.5, you get a 373. So it's kind of up around that 3, you know, that same as a 1 ounce of 750. So I've kind of factored all those things in. And I also think that I'm a very conservative shooter in my shot selection. Like I kind of want to be, like, I'm hunting with pointing dogs. I shoot close range birds. Like the perfect scenario to me is my dog on point. I circle in front of the dog, pin the bird between us, and I'm right on top of that grouse and I'm making a good clean shot. Now, it doesn't happen like that all the time, and then grouse hunting is grouse hunting, so you're going to take some other shots, but I'm pretty conservative. I don't shoot at things way up over the treetops, and a lot of times I probably pass up birds that I absolutely could kill, but I like making good clean kills.
Right.
Nick, what was like the moment when you were like, you just had that moment where you knew it was like, this is it for me. Like, I love this.
Well, yeah, that was like kind of in your notes. So it would be two moments for me, and maybe not singular moments. One specifically was the first time I ever went grouse hunting. This is going way back, like when I'm 9 or 10 years old. And I did not carry a gun that day. I don't think I shot a grouse my first, I'm just talking about like the first time I tagged along with my dad, uncle, and cousin. And I remember driving down a forest road, and my dad and uncle, they stopped the truck and pointed way up ahead, and they're like, there was a grouse standing in the road. And something about that bird just like totally captivated me from that moment on, and probably the rest of the day. And we walked a bunch of trails, and I know we got into some birds that day. We didn't have a dog, just walking along, walking trails and stuff. And my dad and my uncle were carrying guns, and I saw and heard the first grouse flush that day. I remember this thing taking off up from under a little balsam tree, and like, you know, that classic made the sound and flushed and turned into the woods. And like, I don't think my dad or my uncle even raised their gun. You know how grouse are, they're just like gone. And I remember saying like, why didn't you shoot? You know, like, what are you guys doing? But now it all makes sense. So that was the initial spark. And then probably when I got the first bird dog in, you know, and I hunted grouse from that day forward. And when I got my driver's license when I was 16 or whatever, that I really started hunting a lot more with my buddies, and all dogless pretty much. But then when I got the bird dog in 2014, that sort of like, I don't know, re-energize is not the right way to say it, but that like took it to another level, I guess would probably be the best way to describe it. And then now that's just been a completely immersive journey, like with the dogs and just how my hunting and my approach and everything has evolved from there. It's gone to another level.
That's awesome. That's so awesome.
You're on your way, buddy.
I don't know if you could, like, I think you and I talked about this. Like, it's hard to verbalize it, but there's just something like really special about it, you know? And like, I didn't really understand it, I think, till probably I shot my first bird over my dog. And I just remember like feeling electric is the wrong way to describe it, but just like how proud I feel. Like I was just like overcome with joy, like from my soul is the only way I could really describe it, you know? And like, there's maybe a handful of moments in my life where I've ever like kind of felt what I felt in that moment, you know? And it was just like, I mean, that was it. Oh, dude, I was hooked, you know.
Well, you're going to have a lot more moments like that, and you will continue on that path. You know, every year you're going to have something new, and you're still new to this, which is awesome. You got a lot of good stuff ahead of you, and you know, you got the dog, you got the double gun fascination. You're well on your way, buddy. I'm happy for you.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Dan, was there a moment that, like, would it be back on the farm? Like was there a moment that, like, grouse kind of captivated you, or upland birds, I should say?
I think what really captivated me with the grouse was in West Virginia with my uncle. We had came off of a – everything is so steep in that part of West Virginia. They're short hills, but they're steep. So you're side hilling all day long, and you try to get on that log skidder path, you know, and your buddy's above you or below you on the next one. And I remember us coming up on this, it was like a big Russian olive, and seven grouse came out of that thing.
What?
And both of us missed. I shot three times with my Model 37. My uncle shot twice. Seven birds came out, and it was one after the other. Boom, boom. And it was like, wow. And then later on that day, he killed one. He got one. And that was the first time I actually ever held a grouse. And I just was amazed at how, not just how beautiful they are, but like how light they are for their size. Like right away, you could tell why they're so fast. Like their size to weight ratio just doesn't seem right. You know, I just thought it was such a cool animal. A little crown on her head, you know, a beautiful tail. I was hooked.
I'm certain we're not alone in that, and that's the one thing I've said it before, but you know, I didn't have dogs early on, so it wasn't the dog work and the relationship between dog and bird is like, that is absolutely like a very special component to the hunt. But before that, for me, and it sounds like for you too, Dan, it was just the bird. The ruffed grouse in and of itself is just such a neat bird, and that really captured my interest for a long, long time before the setters came along. But I'm happy I got them both now.
Yeah, and it's the places they live, you know, like especially West Virginia. You're on these steep hillsides. There's butternut everywhere. Just these thick, timbered off hillsides. It's not like walking through a field pheasant hunting, you know. Any kind of like agricultural lands. There's just something special about where grouse are, not only grouse themselves, but where they are and how they react to hunters. How does something with a brain the size of a peanut know that, hey, I got to get around the other side of this little evergreen tree and then take off? You know, they know. I've been in Pennsylvania where we were in open cover one day, and there was one big mountain laurel, probably about 8 feet tall, 8 feet wide. And I said to my buddy, and I remember it was raining really hard. I said to my buddy, I'm like, get ready. If there's one here, he's going to be in that. And sure enough, you know, that classic sound. We got right on top of that bird. I mean, we were 8 yards from that laurel when he took off. He didn't want to fly because he was soaking wet. Neither one of us. We were 15 yards apart from each other. Neither one of us saw that bird. We didn't get an eyeball on that bird. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yep.
They're just so slick.
A lot of years of natural selection and escaping predators.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. They say the market hunters had a lot to do with that. Like, that's why in like Pennsylvania or New York, you'll get 20 yards and they take off, where places, you know, in Canada and northern Maine, you can walk right up to them, basically. A lot of times.
Yep.
New England grouse shooting, I think the book is called.
Harn and Foster.
Harn and Foster, great book. He talks about that in length and how they evolved differently.
Yeah, I love that book.
And anywhere within 100 miles of a major city. Pretty cool.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Tyler, what's your favorite tailgate bourbon?
Favorite tailgate bourbon? Well, that's a good question.
If you have a favorite post-hunt tailgate brown liquor, I only ask because the listeners don't know this, but you work for Buffalo Trace.
Yes, sir. Well,
I will say this, and your listeners might be upset that I say this, but it's okay. I could drink Buffalo Trace all day, every day, you know. The value is, you know, $26.99 for a fifth, 8 to 10 year old bourbon. It's phenomenal. I've had plenty of Pappy Van Winkle, Weller, Buffalo Trace Antique Collection, and they're phenomenal bourbons too, right? But Buffalo Trace, just bang for your buck. There's just something about it. For me, like, that's all I need. Or a Sazerac Rye, maybe. That's like a $19.99 for a fifth. Same thing. Either one of those. Those would do it for me. I don't really
I like that. It's the economy bourbon selection, you know?
Yeah, I'll enjoy Pappy Van Winkle, don't get me wrong, if it's around. But Buffalo Trace, honestly, sometimes if I'm having bourbon with friends when they're over and I've got an open bottle of Van Winkle in the cellar, nine times out of ten, I'm reaching for Buffalo Trace. And that's the God's honest truth.
I think Buffalo Trace sponsors some podcasts, Tyler. You pull any strings for me, or we do something there?
Well, Dan said that maybe I could pull some strings, but we would have to make it out to Minnesota to chase some birds with you at some point. Dan, yeah, that could
easily be arranged. So let's figure that out, boys.
Definitely do that.
And then you know what, Nick? Maybe since Dan insulted me yesterday, I'll bring you to the New York honey hole for grouse from a childhood friend of mine. Since, you know, Dan said what he said yesterday. But yeah.
That's okay. I'll hunt the 50 honey holes I have around you.
Oh, I love it. All right, guys. Well, this has been a blast, and we could obviously, you know, if we started pouring some Buffalo Trace, we could go on for hours, but we will save that for another time, perhaps when the three of us are together around, sitting on a tailgate or in a cabin somewhere. I would like that.
Plucking birds.
Yeah, exactly. But I really appreciate you guys joining me for this episode of the show. It was fun getting to know both of you. And anything else you guys want to leave the listeners with?
Shoot more.
Yeah. Thanks for having us, Nick. Appreciate it.
All right, you bet, guys. Hang on with me for just a second. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gundog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gundog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.